Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, Pod Shots.
What is it?
On the card, shoot out the red dot in the middle. You have five chances in which to do it. You pick any choice prize in the house.
What is it?
And the elbow rest is permitted.
Oh, that right. I don't need no rest.
All of the red must be removed in order to win.
What do you mean?
All the red must be removed.
I should go on and hand me that there tiger.
Step right up.
Test the right where you is. I don't find that.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Pod Shots. I am your host, Eric Williams. For this episode, we are discussing the 2013 film Child of God. Based on the book by Cormac McCarthy, the film was co-written by James Franco and Vince Jolivet, I think is maybe how you say that name. The film was directed by James Franco and stars Scott Hayes. Here to discuss the film with me is returning guest, Mr. Zach Crucey.
Hi!
Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that this podcast is brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. And I also do want to mention that Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/plainlabelpodcast and choose from over 180,000 audio programs. Download a title free and start listening. It's just that simple. So go to audibletrial.com/plainlabelpodcast and get started today. So, Mr. Crucey, let's talk a little bit about some booze.
I'm just drinking water.
Oh my God. This is a terrible, terrible trend that's happening.
I know. Taking care of my body.
Taking care of it is awful. You know, this is like a Ben Teed kind of move. I don't necessarily appreciate it. Rachel gives me this horseshit about Whole30, and so she's not been drinking recently. I feel like I'm a man on an island here.
What's a Whole30?
That's where you try to behave yourself for 30 days.
Oh, that's horseshit. I'm not doing that. I've just had a lot of beer lately, and I'm just...
just coming down.
Yeah, I'm just coming down. Yeah, just taking it easy for a little while, because... the weekend's coming up, and yeah,
I'm kind of priming for the weekend, is what I'll call it.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's fair.
It makes me feel better about myself.
Yeah, that's not such a bad idea. Just Memorial Day weekend just kind of hit me hard. So
yeah, well, understandable, especially with your current neighbors.
Yeah,
those no nothings.
No, those party time teens.
Yeah.
No, they're gone,
man. Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah, they're solid gone, yeah. Somebody bought that house, and they had to go in and just, like, completely renovate, like, just all of the inside. Yeah, they just had to gut the inside of it, yeah, because the party time teens just trashed it, so.
They could go to Lowe's and get a lot of supplies they might need there.
Yeah, they could. I wouldn't recommend it.
I'm having a beverage tonight.
What you having?
I'm having a Bloody Mary. Simple.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Tasty.
Little,
is it like one?
It's a little shitty V8 mix. So, you know.
Oh, so you didn't make yourself like a real elaborate one with like the pickle and like a sausage and like 14 olives and a mushroom and like hot sauce.
You're making me feel bad about my choice.
I'm not making you feel bad about it. I'm just saying I like when it, on the rare occasion that I'll have one of those, I like them basically to be like a stew with vodka in it.
Oh yeah. You know, yeah. I think that what I like about it is I enjoy sodium.
Mm.
And so a Bloody Mary is a good place to go for that.
Yes.
And so I'll just get all of the sodiums.
Yes, all of the sodium.
Yeah. So that's what I'm having. Okay, so why don't we go ahead and kick off our discussion of the 2013 film Child of God.
He had that rifle from when he was just a boy.
Step right up, folks. On the car. Shoot out the red dot in the middle.
I'll say one thing. He could shoot it. Did anything he could see.
Mm-hmm. That's right. See right where you is.
Morning, Sheriff.
Let's go.
Where do you reckon they is, Sheriff?
You oughtn't to mind helping us unscramble a little misunderstanding.
Okay.
But what things is you've done we ain't found out yet?
I see your driver's license.
You ain't the law.
You tell us where you put them bodies.
His name was Lester Ballard, a child of God.
Drop the rifle, Ballard.
Much like yourself, perhaps.
The IMDb plot synopsis goes like this. Set in the mountainous Sevier County, Tennessee, Child of God tells the story of Lester Ballard, a dispossessed violent man whom the narrator describes as a child of God much like yourself, perhaps. Ballard's life is a disastrous attempt to exist outside the social order. Successfully deprived of parents and homes, and with few other ties, Ballard descends literally and figuratively to the level of a cave dweller as he falls deeper into crime and degradation. So, before getting into the actual film version, tell me about you and the book version. About, I know that you're a Cormac McCarthy guy.
Yes, I do love the Cormac McCarthy.
Specifically, Blood Meridian.
Yeah, that's my favorite novel of all time. I mean, it's Blood Meridian, then there's this Steep Cliff and everything else after it, at least for me. But anyway, yeah, so I read Child of God, you know, well after I read Blood Meridian. It's a very good novel. It's a very short novel. I read it in one sitting. I read it in an afternoon. It's only like 130 or something pages, so not very long. and it's really terrific. Have you read it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's McCarthy. It's one of McCarthy's earlier novels. It's before he got the Genius Grant. Or just before Sutri, which is, was his most major work before, Blood Meridian.
Mm-hmm.
And in this novel, I think McCarthy is often compared to Faulkner in the way that he sort of constructs his sentences, or constructs his novels. I mean, Faulkner is dealing a lot, usually uses a lot of, dependent clauses to, you know, string along these long sentences.
Sure,
where
sure.
McCarthy does the opposite. He puts together just a whole bunch of independent clauses to create, you know, paragraph long sentences. But I think in Child of God, he's at his most Faulknerian, mm-hmm. in terms of the style of writing. It's very Faulkner-like, and the way that the novel is constructed is also very Faulkner-like as well, because it sort of shifts back and forth between narrators, and they're all narrating similar events, and the timeline just sort of circles around around Lester's doings.
Yeah, it's very vignette-based instead of just a narrative.
Right, and that's a lot like that's again. I mean, that's a very Faulknerian, mm-hmm. Tactic, I guess. As I Lay Dying, which James Franco also unfortunately adapted into a film version, kind of does the same thing, where you have they're almost vignette like, where you have like just a rotating sort of series of narrators just sort of explaining what's going on to you, mm-hmm. along with the omniscient voice of that sort of binds them all together. But anyway, so that's when he's writing this, and it's really pretty early in his career as far as that stuff goes. But he's dealing with a lot of the same themes, and I suspect we'll touch on some of these when we get into the movie itself. But he's really interested in peregrination. He's interested in people who are walking around places. He'll have characters travel by car or plane or whatever, but more often than not, in his novels, his characters travel by foot, mm-hmm. or by horseback. But very rarely, are motor vehicles involved. So that happens a lot with Lester. But the biggest thing that McCarthy is interested in is taking, otherwise ordinary, even if odd, people and putting them in extreme situations and just taking people and just pushing them to their absolute limits and then just sort of finding out what happens. He sort of takes that sort of basis and then folds it in with his other interests, sort of in naturalism and death and all of those things, just to sort of all those things sort of coalesce into these really messy, violent, disturbed situations and places, that are also, this is the last thing, and then, those places are also generally the place where he's at the time, like physically located. So like when he's writing Child of God and Suttree, he's living in Knoxville at the time. He's living in Tennessee at the time. So, and both of those novels take place there. When his Southwestern novels, like Blood Meridian
All the Pretty Horses
the Border Trilogy, those all take place in the American Southwest, where McCarthy had then, had recently moved to, once he started really working in Blood Meridian in earnest. So he's not really a regional writer. He's typically just writing about the region that he's in that moment. That's not always true, but that's more true than it's not. So again, he's taking all of those ideas and just sort of folding them, always folding them into, this disturbed, strange place that's, not only disturbed, but sometimes darkly comical. Like really yes. darkly comical.
Yes.
So that's sort of Child of God in a nutshell without spoiling too much of it.
Sure. Yeah. I did read this and I sent you a text during, one of the passages and I was like, oh wow, Lester Ballard, he's quite the guy.
Yes.
And you're like, oh, he's a peach or, something to that effect. Mm-hmm. And then I put, something about, because as I was reading, I put something about him in the car. It comes across the couple.
Oh yeah.
And I was like, yeah. Wow, that's something. And you're like, keep going.
Yeah, it gets so much worse, right? And the first time when I read that scene, when I was like, man, that's weird that he's jerking off outside the car. I mean, That's sick. Okay. But I mean, it's disturbed, but it's, there's something that's kind of funny about that,
sure.
I guess.
Sure.
But then later on, when they've, when they've accidentally suffocated. He finds the body and he starts sort of just messing around with the body. Like I love that scene because he's taking his time with it and he's like trying to figure out like what he should do and like, is this okay? I mean, mm-hmm. he's kind of like gradually like pushing the envelope to see, you know, to see what's going to happen next.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I mean, it's just so, it happens really quickly, but it's just so painstaking. And, you know, he walks away and he comes back
three or four different
times. And like, I mean, he's really like processing all this. Like, yeah, I think I can do this. Well, maybe, should I do this? Yeah, maybe I can do this. Maybe, you know, and it's just this back and forth, you know, that's going on just within himself before he decides to become this thing.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, and that was one of the things that really struck me is you know, you get what I liked about the book is I think that you know, and I won't get too in depth in this before we get into the movie, but I liked how McCarthy doesn't necessarily feed you everything.
No.
Right? Like it doesn't say specifically, "Oh, Lester walked up to this couple and they had suffocated in the car."
Right.
And they were dead. It's just like you're kind of figuring it out as he's figuring it out.
Yeah.
And he's doing these despicable acts, but I'm also watching him going, oh shit, I hope he doesn't get caught. Mm-hmm. You know, or I'm reading along going, oh no, don't grab her, like, don't grab her breast. What are you doing? You're going to get caught. You know, and then later I'm like, oh my God, what are you doing now? Like, this is not okay. You know, those are things where I was kind of like along with him. And that was what I put in the notes for the film too, is in moments I'm with him, and then the movie's like, no, no, no. And the book, more specifically, is like, no, you shouldn't be with him.
Right. Yeah, yeah. The book does a much better job of that than the movie.
Mm-hmm.
A lot better job with that. Because I think a lot of what's going on with this, too, is McCarthy's inspired by, it probably isn't the right way to put it, but McCarthy, like a lot of other authors and a lot of other sort of storytellers of that time period, you know, about 10 to 15 year time period, are really interested in people like Ed Gein.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I don't think it's absolutely not a one-to-one transfer, but I mean, a lot of this reads to me like if Ed Gein lived in Knoxville.
Yeah, like an uneducated, unsophisticated mountain man kind of a killer.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, if Huck Finn were Ed Gein. I mean, nice. Really.
Yeah.
Because, and it's not as obvious or it's not as clear in the film, I don't think. But, you know, towards the end when he's hiding out in the caves, I mean, that's kind of like Huck and Tom Sawyer in the cave, right? Sure. They retreat into the caves and that's sort of like their secret place. And, there's sort of that rebirth moment, you know, towards the end of the novel where he climbs out, you know, just again, just like Tom and Huck, when they have to escape. And so, I read it as if Huck Finn were Ed Gein and they lived in Knoxville instead of, you know, Hannibal, Missouri.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Well, let's get into the actual film then. And, tell me about when you had first come across this. Like was this something that you kind of, were like, oh, it's, you know, like, are you on the lookout for Cormac McCarthy adaptations or were you like, oh, I've read this book before. I know this title, you know?
I don't remember, to be honest with you. Oh, you know what? Now I do remember because I had read the book before. I was trying to think if I had sought it out or if I got an email notification about it. Our local art house movie theater, the Cinema Center, was playing it, and I'm on their email list. So I got the list of the films that they were showing. I said, "Child of God, what the hell?" And so they were showing it, and I saw it. I saw it there, and then my wife and I, we found a way to watch it at our house as well. So, but yeah, that I just kind of stumbled upon it by accident. I didn't really know anything about it, until, until the theater notified me that it was there.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah.
I guess I came across it just in, you know, in preparation for the recording. It's on Netflix Instant now if people want to check it out at home. As I mentioned, it is a James Franco directed film. It is an adaptation of a Cormac McCarthy book. And so I'm like, well, is there a reason why I haven't heard of this yet? Because it's kind of like All the Pretty Horses with Matt Damon. And, I'm like, why did that not get a bigger release?
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's Cormac McCarthy, it's Matt Damon. Like, is there a reason why I don't know what this is? You know?
Yeah, I think maybe it's just because it was such a limited release to begin with Franco. And I don't know, the Rotten Tomatoes reviews on it were pretty mixed as well. It just never got a wide release.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it is what it is. And there's a lot of McCarthy fans that that were displeased with it as well. So.
Okay. Well, let's get into the actual film then. What did you think overall of the adaptation and the film?
You know, the first time I watched it, I enjoyed it. I thought it was pretty good. I didn't think it was perfect. But I didn't expect it to be perfect. I mean, I think that's kind of an absurd, thing to ask for. Especially when you're emotionally tied to the source material anyway. But, so the first time I watched it, I thought it was okay. I was a little bummed out by the ending.
yes.
But, the second time I watched it, like, I was even less enamored with it, because the second time I watched it, it was in pretty quick succession. It kind of struck me that Franco completely misinterpreted the novel.
Mm.
Because, you know, my viewing of Franco's version is that Franco seems to think, I think he seems to think that the book is about, mental illness, and he treats Lester really sympathetically throughout most of the movie. There are moments where you kind of get pulled back, but I think that's really kind of a byproduct of the novel. And it's not, to me, the book is not about that at all. It's about the things that, you know, I kind of already mentioned before. McCarthy's not really interested in, until he writes The Road, and really, like, well, really not until after he's written Blood Meridian is McCarthy at all interested in morality. Presenting his audience with a sense of morality and saying, this is right, this is wrong. He's saying these are things as they are, or these are what people do in extreme situations, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that the film, I think, treats Lester with so much sympathy is a kind of a big misinterpretation of not just the book, but McCarthy in general, because I just don't, it just does that sort of, that just doesn't work for me.
Do you think that part of that has to do with the casting of Scott Hayes?
No, well, it could, it could be Hayes's performance, but I think it's as much Franco as anything else. Cause to tell you the truth, I mean, outside of sort of that sympathetic, feeling, I mean, I think Hayes is actually pretty good as Lester. I like him as Lester. I don't know how you feel about it, but I liked him. So I think it's Franco. And another reason that I think it's Franco is because I saw around the same time I saw his adaptation of As I Lay Dying, which was also just a complete disaster.
I've yet to see that.
Yeah. And it has several of the same cast members. It's just not well done.
Mm.
I got it. I saw what he was trying to go for, but it just doesn't work. I think Child of God is much better, like way better than his As I Lay Dying. But I mean, again, I just think that, you know, seeing those two together just, again, sort of gave me sort of ammunition, or maybe the evidence, however you want to frame it, to say that, like, all right, Franco doesn't get it.
Interesting.
He's misunderstood the work. Yeah.
I think going back to Scott Hayes and his performance, I think what I was struck by from him was, it's a weird thing. Like, when, you know, everyone, I think, or I believe they should, visualizes their character when they're reading, right? Visualizes your main character, at least in some way, even if it's not explicitly described how he looks. And I guess I saw Lester as not as attractive as Scott Hayes, because I felt like he, to me, looked like an actor playing a, like he was playing a person.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. I can see that.
And so I was like, okay, well, he's a little pretty for me, I guess. And he, I don't know, and maybe this is something that I completely missed. I didn't think he was old enough. Because I thought Lester was like, you know, a good dozen years older than how he's portrayed.
Yeah. I guess I kind of just, I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you. I guess I just kind of let that slide.
Sure.
Because again, it was just something I kind of expected. You know what I mean? I think you're right. I mean, an older actor or making Hayes at least appear older would have been better, or a better choice. But, you know, I guess I just kind of figured that, you know, I mean, people are always prettier in the movie than,
oh, sure,
than I ever imagined them to be in the books, right?
Sure.
And even, I mean, just as another McCarthy example, I mean, even in No Country for Old Men, I mean, Javier Bardem is still a little prettier than I picture, what's his face? It doesn't matter, but anyway.
Yeah, the bad guy in No Country.
Yeah, I can't. I'm embarrassed that I can't think of his name, but anyway. So, I mean, that he's too pretty didn't bother me too much. I guess I was more worried with, I was more offended, if that's the right word, by the misinterpretation, I guess.
Mm, yeah.
But I do think you're right. I think that's a good point.
Because I guess I guess looking at it with people that they have there, like if they would have someone that looked more like, not this particular person, but looked more like how Tim Blake Nelson looks.
Yeah.
You know, to where you're like, well, he's not a guy that's just going to go up to someone and get the benefit of the doubt.
Right. Like, yeah.
He's a little funny looking guy.
Yeah.
Right? And so, I don't know, like, he just seemed like, Scott Hayes just seems like, oh, sure, he's a little dirty, but whatever. It wasn't like, I don't know if you've seen this Western, but it's a John Hillcoat film, The Proposition.
Mm-mm.
And he's also the director that did The Road.
But
that's an Australian Western with, Ray Winstone and Guy Pearce and, John Hurt. And everyone is, you know, it's in Australia and it's a Western and everyone is fucking filthy. And all of their teeth are just disgusting. And they look like they lived in the time that they lived and not like this was, you know, the Wild West or anything like that. But, you know, Lester doesn't have pearly whites. I wouldn't imagine.
No.
And so every time he's screaming and I see like these perfect teeth, I'm like, you know, and that's just kind of, I think, a first view, like, letting little things bother me like that.
Yeah, no, those are all pretty fair criticisms, too, I think. I guess they were just the things that I was least frustrated by.
Well, sure, I mean, if you, you know, you start watching it and you're like, wait a minute, this interpretation is incorrect. You know, you have much bigger fish to fry than, his teeth don't look how I thought. You know?
Yeah,
I mean, those are much bigger problems. I can definitely see where at times, I felt like James Franco thought he was mentally handicapped.
Yeah. Franco thinks he's mentally ill, or that he has some sort of, dissociative disorder, or not dissociative disorder, but like, some sort of cognitive problem. Right.
Yeah. And there's some of it through the performance of, you know, the kind of muttering to himself and the way that the tone of his voice goes up and down, as he's saying different lines. But I kind of felt bad for Scott Hayes because I kind of liked him, even though I didn't think he was perfect for the role. But I thought that he was giving it his all. Like, I was like, okay, well, he's going for it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, yeah, I thought he was okay. I thought he was fine. I mean, performance-wise, but, I mean, aside from the looks, performance-wise, I thought he was fine. But again, I mean, that, and I guess that, again, that's what brings me back to thinking that this is not Hayes thinking that the character is, you know, disabled. It's Franco assuming that the character is disabled. Mm-hmm. And he's not. So far as I can tell from the novel version, or so far as I can remember from the novel version, I mean, there's nothing to indicate that he has that kind of issue. He's just a backwards person who is living in Knoxville in the 1950s and clearly has no education and is, you know, a hill person.
Sure.
Right. And then is put in an extreme situation because he loses the only thing that could possibly have value to him is his property. Mm-hmm. Right. And then that just drives him over the edge. Like I said, you know, when we started the discussion, I mean, that's what McCarthy's interested in. He's taking ordinary, if not off-kilter people, and then putting them in the most extreme situations, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And like seeing what happens to them. So, and to assume or presume that the character is, you know, mentally handicapped or disabled is, you know, flies completely in the face of what McCarthy's always done.
Sure.
He's not interested in that. And when he has those characters, I mean, he presents those characters in under really extreme circumstances. Like he points out, you know, he puts them in cages and not to degrade them, but to show how they're degraded by other people, you mm-hmm. know, and that doesn't really happen so much with Lester. I mean, he loses his property, but I mean, he doesn't really end up in a cage until the end of the novel.
Or at all in the end of this movie.
Yeah, and not at all in the movie. Right, exactly.
So that's another reason why it doesn't get it. The movie doesn't get the book.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, and one of the things that I think it's so belittling to the character to make him come off as he's mentally handicapped or he's got some sort of mental issue. Because that's not, like you were saying, that's not what McCarthy's writing the character like. Because right. You could think, oh, well, he's doing these things because he doesn't know better because he's mentally handicapped or disabled. You know, yeah. that's not the way that he's writing them. No, he's doing these things and he's fully capable of being a standard or a normal or a typical person.
Right. I mean, it's a situation where the novel gives us no reason to assume or to believe that he was anything other than that before the bank and comes and auctions off his home.
Yeah. Now I will say that I really did like that first scene when his home is being auctioned off or where they're at least attempting to.
Yeah.
Because I really thought that, I was like, oh, okay, Franco, like, yeah, you're getting this because the camera's kind of moving and it's unstable. And I'm like, okay, this is kind of representing Lester Ballard's personality because he's also unstable, you know, and he's losing this one thing and it's kind of swirling around and not able to focus on any one thing. And I was like, all right, this is a representation of his mind. Like, okay, I get this. And then it completely goes away from that and doesn't come back to that at all. And I was like, what the hell?
Yeah, no, I kind of felt the same way. I was all excited when I saw the first scene. I was like, oh, but he gets it. This is pretty close to how I imagined it. Mm-hmm. People sitting in their trucks and yeah, I mean, that part of it felt right. But like you said, it just kind of falls to pieces after that.
Yeah. So you already mentioned the sequence where the couple is on one of the mountains and I forget the name of the mountain, but, and they're, having a little tomfoolery and Lester decides to masturbate outside the car and they see him and that was a scene where it was kind of like, oh, this is embarrassing, but it's still funny and I don't know how I'm supposed to feel. And that was kind of enjoyable in the book. And I think that was done fairly well in the movie version. And the main sequence and the sequence that, you know, that I will remember this book from. Or four is in part two, which I don't know that was necessary that they kept putting those title cards in there because it didn't make any difference in the movie version.
No,
you know, putting them there. But it was in part two, and it's when he finds the two finds the couple that have been asphyxiated, I guess. And when he's, you know, molesting the girl and keeps walking back and forth and taking money out of the wallet and the picture and just, you know, kind of taking things one step farther. And like I was saying, I was sitting there, you know, hands on my head going, oh no, don't do this, while I was reading it. And to see that on screen, I was like, okay, that's pretty close, you know, and they hear the gunshot in the distance and he's kind of nervous. And I was like, all right, I can appreciate that. And so the film was very frustrating to me at times because I was like, okay, they're getting this right, but all of this isn't right. But what over here, this is good too. And no, this isn't right here. You know, So it was like a thing where it was almost more frustrating to me than if the film would have just not been of any quality of any perceived quality from me. It's the fact that it was getting things right that I really enjoyed, and then it was missing the mark on so many things. It was kind of pulling me back and forth, so to speak.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think one of the more wasted opportunities is towards the end when Lester comes when he tries to retake his property and he's dressed.
Yes.
He's dressed as a woman and he's wearing, the scalp of one of his victims. It's the point where he's, you know, at his most crazed, I guess. In the novel, I mean, that scene is so intense.
Yes.
I mean, and I just, when I saw the film version of that, it just felt like the wind was just sucked out of a lot of it. It just felt very quick and it felt abrupt and it just didn't, there wasn't that sort of intensity there. Right. I guess to me, the comparison I made, you know, as far as film versions go, especially with the Ed Gein angle is, you know, in Psycho, you get that moment with, you get that moment where, you know, where Norman shows up and, you know, he's got the wig and you find the mother in the fruit cellar and she's a skeleton. I mean, that's a really intense moment, right? And it's not dissimilar from what's kind of going on with Lester, except Lester's is just so much more violent, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so if I'm comparing those two sort of scenes, you know, from the films, you know, the Psycho version of it is just incredible. Right. And it's just really powerful, shocking scene. And I just didn't think there was anything shocking about or necessarily shocking about when Lester shows up, because it's not clear that that's a scalp.
Right.
It's not clear why he's dressed the way that he is. I mean, there's just a lot of buildup that should be there. And a lot of the strangeness is just stripped from it. And it just fell flat for me. I just didn't care.
Yeah, I saw him and you see the turn, the reveal, and he's got the makeup on and he's got the wig and all that. And I thought, Dark Knight Joker.
Yeah.
To where it came off as, oh, that's weird.
Yeah.
All right.
It's more comical.
Yeah.
Than anything else. And it's not supposed to be comical. I mean, there's something mildly humorous about it, but it's not supposed to play that way. You know, I mean, that's not a moment in the story that's supposed to play as funny. That's a woman's scalp that he's wearing, you know?
You know, what I would have loved to see, and, you know, I love playing armchair director, but I would have liked something along the lines of seeing that from a distance instead of being right on him all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing that from a distance, from either the house's perspective or the old man who took over his property, and seeing this like lumbering person, but in woman's clothes and with long hair,
mm-hmm.
and then sort of slowly getting that reveal that it's Lester in these clothes, right? Yeah. I would have rather have seen that or have seen nothing and then getting the reveal of him. And I would have preferred, you know, like the wig being askew or something to where you know that it's just, you know, like, or it's a messy scalping or something. Like that was a pretty good job. Like he did a pretty good job of making it fit perfectly on his head.
Yeah.
And taking the skin off of a woman. But I was thinking, like, God, something just, you know, I was thinking about this before recording, and I was like, something other than what you did is what I would have liked to see. Yeah. You know, like, there's plenty of other choices that could have been done, and I would have, you know, that it's not like the movie is beholden to the book in all forms, so no. why not do something a little different?
Well, yeah, I agree. I think that's something I suspect you would agree with this, but it doesn't have to be exactly like the book. There's no reason to assume that it should, right?
Sure.
But I just think this movie needed a different, or maybe if not just a different, but a stronger sort of voice from the director, right? Like if this were, say, I mean, I realize these are extreme in comparisons, but I mean, if this were, say, like the Coen brothers, mm-hmm. or Paul Thomas Anderson, or somebody like that, right? Like,
man, imagine how weird that would be if it was Paul Thomas Anderson.
But I think that he would be, you know, an appropriate choice for it.
Sure. Right?
Because he's going to make changes to the narrative, but they're changes that are sort of in line with his sort of vision of how films should be made and how, you know, these sort of visual narratives should be constructed, but while still, you know, maintaining some sort of fealty to what the story, what the novel actually is, mm-hmm. as opposed to just imagining it's something that it's not and then saying, okay, well, I did it, you know. It feels like, to me, Franco is more, it is less of Paul Thomas Anderson or Coen Brothers type and more a Zack Snyder type, where he thinks if he just shows all of the scenes from the story, from the source material, he just shows them all in the right order, then he's done it. You know?
Yeah.
Then
forget about any sort of subtext or anything like that. Yeah. Just give me the scene.
Yeah, exactly. And it just doesn't work that way, right? I mean, that's why Watchmen doesn't work as a film.
Right.
It's just, here's the scene. Remember that scene? Yep, there it is, completely flat and lifeless. Wow, did you think it was great? I did. You know, I mean, it just doesn't work. It just needs more of a voice behind it. And like you're saying, I mean, change the angle, you know, like make the, you know, shoot it from like the inside of the house where you see Lester lumbering along. Mm-hmm. Show the woman that he cut the scalp off of. So we at least have some sort of sense as to where that hair came from, you know, something.
Well, I mean, they do show when he's sifting through the beginning of the fire at the beginning of the movie, like he pulls out, he finds a knife,
mm-hmm.
but you know, he never uses the knife, right?
No.
So show a sequence where he's like either just like wiping off a knife or something and picking up just something indistinct in off the ground.
Yeah.
And just to show that it's hair. I mean, we don't have to see specifically him doing it, but give us a little hint of it. And then you don't have to have that long tracking shot of following him.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. Little things here and there could have made it much tighter and made it make more sense.
That was a big missed opportunity. I also thought that the second time he comes across people alive that are in a car, I thought that was a big miss too.
Yeah.
So he comes across them, you know, and he kills the guy real quickly. And then I believe in the book, he walks the girl down and away from the car for a while and shoots her in the back of the head. And here he just kind of shoots her right away. And I was like, wait a minute. Like this is like, I feel like you're just taking me through the steps and it's like, okay, today we're shooting page 990 and here's what happens, you know, just like what you were saying with the Zack Snyder stuff. And I was like, well, that doesn't make the story. Like, what do you, okay. You know, and I was getting more and more weary as we went. Like, wait a minute. What did you make of, one of the sequences that I did think worked was him at the carnival when he's shooting?
Oh yeah, that one totally works.
And so I was like, oh yeah, I like that when he's like, no, I'm not done and doing all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That's when I was sort of a little charmed by him and I was like, oh yeah, I like this.
Yeah, no, I think that scene totally works. And it doesn't work. The problem is it works on its own.
Right.
Right. But it doesn't work within the rest of the context of the movie.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because all of a sudden, like, he has his wits about him and he knows, like, when he's being conned and he's not mentally disabled.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, he's screwy, but he's not, he doesn't have some sort of cognitive disability or something. So, like, I think that scene totally works on its own, but it doesn't work in the rest of the movie. Just like the opening scene of the auction, right?
Yeah.
Great. It's awesome. And then, but it doesn't work with the rest of it.
Yeah. And that's when we have, you know, he has those big animals. And do you remember that from the animals where he's kind of like losing it and keeps shooting them? Do you remember that from the book?
Yeah, yeah. He keeps all those animals and he brings them with him out to that. It's pretty similar to the film where he takes out, he wins all those animals.
Sure.
And he brings them with him out to the cabin and he kind of.
Well, I know he like steps and like he sets them up. Right. Mm-hmm. When he has his frozen, female companion, whatever you want to call her.
Yeah.
But I didn't remember him like setting them up and shooting them all.
No. I don't remember that either. I thought you were asking like, I thought you were saying, did he bring them back or?
Oh, no. Yeah. I remember how he won them and that was kind of like his audience while he's on this little date with her. And I think that was another one where that could have been like, that was, I was kind of like, I thought it was pretty safe. Like, it's like, okay, well, yeah, that's kind of disturbing, but it wasn't as disturbing as it could have been.
Right.
You know, like I didn't feel like I needed a shower when I was done with the scene. And I felt like I needed a shower when I read that in the book.
Right. Yeah. But no, in the novel, I mean, he carries those things around with him forever until he can't anymore. and it's kind of heartbreaking when he loses them.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I don't remember. I mean, that could be in there, but I don't remember it.
Yeah, I don't recall that part. And you know, one of the things also is, you know, and I get that even though it's a short novel that you can't have everything in the novel from in a filmed version, but I remember sequences like when he goes to town after his house is burned down and he's concerned because they might find the bones of the woman.
Right.
And they're like, oh, that was just like such and such's house. And they didn't find anything. And then Lester's curious and asks, you know, not a single thing or whatever the line is. Yeah. And that was another little thing where it's like, no, he has his faculties about him because he realizes he shouldn't be doing this. And he realizes he's going to get in deep shit if he's found out.
Right.
And so, but that's just completely forgotten in this or breezed over.
I think Franco decided what he thought the book was about and then just sort of played fast and loose with it. You know, he, lots of confirmation bias. He picked the scenes that sort of support, you know, the vision that he had for it and not the ones that didn't.
Sure. Okay. And so, tell me what you think about the end.
I didn't like it. Because it wouldn't have taken much to sort of finish it.
Mm-hmm.
In the end of the book, you know, Lester is committed. He's never charged with any crime. He's committed, to a mental institution and they treat him like an animal, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like McCarthy does when, you know, when people in McCarthy's worlds assume that someone is deranged in some way, they treat them like animals and they put them in a cage and he's ultimately, you know, and then he dies of really under really mundane circumstances. Not, it's suggested pneumonia, but he gets pneumonia and then he's better. And then a couple of days later he dies.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then he's, you know, his body is just basically destroyed. Everything about him is destroyed, and used and examined and poked and prodded by medical students. I think that's kind of a more, and then of course after that, then, there's another coda or whatever where, there's a farmer, the farmer's working the fields and, his mules fall into a sinkhole.
Oh, right.
And they disappear. And then once these kids climb down to the sinkhole and they find all this sort of menagerie of dead bodies mm-hmm. that had been there for all this time, all Lester's victims, and they're all sort of posed in these horrific, you know, in these horrific poses, I guess. They're posed in poses. And they're all covered with, like, mushrooms and mold and that sort of thing.
Yeah, because it's cold and damp down there, right?
Right, yeah. And, you know, and even if you leave that last bit out of it, I mean, you know, Lester dying at the end or Lester being caged at the end, it just is more satisfying to me. And I think it's extra strange that they don't include that, because that ending fits in what Franco seems to think the book is about.
Yes, yes.
Right? So that strikes me as even more strange that he leaves that out of there. It just doesn't work, because if the novel is sort of Huck Finn as Ed Gein, right? Like, Huck Finn can light out for the territories, right? Huck Finn could, you know, who's already living on the fringes of society can just abandon it, right? Mm-hmm. But in McCarthy's world, you can't just light out for the territories. There is no escape, right? Death comes for everyone. I mean, that's sort of like one of like the primary rules of reading McCarthy books. Everybody dies. Right. I mean, even if not every character dies, the message is that you're going to die. You can't, there is no escape.
Right. Look at the road, right?
Yeah. I mean, look at the road, Blood Meridian. I mean, Child of God, et cetera. I mean, all of them. I mean, that's the clear sort of message there. I mean, again, it's naturalism, right? I mean, that's Faulkner too. I mean, those are his influences. They're all preoccupied with death and the inescapability of it. And that's, you know, why the novel ends the way it does. I mean, it ends in death after death after death after death. The ending was just really unsatisfying for me, because he can't just escape. He can't light up for the territories. He has to die. You know, because that's what sort of completes the narrative, you know, completes the arc for him.
Yeah. Well, I thought, you know, I was watching it and I'm like, okay, I'm kind of losing the thread a little bit here. Like, I'm not really, I don't know here. And, you know, he's going through the caves and he's escaping the police or escaping the group, you know, and I'm like, all right, you know, this is following pretty closely, and he's going to get out and then he's going to get arrested and, you know, go to the mental hospital, et cetera. And he just runs off and it ends. And I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, wait a minute. Like, some of the other stuff, I'm like, okay, well, Franco doesn't get it. And now I'm like, wow, he really, like, what are you doing? Like, he can't, because you're not supposed to be rooting for Lester.
No.
Right? And when it ends that way, you're like, oh yeah, he made it. He made it. He escaped and he was killed all of them and didn't get caught. I mean, that's the way that I would imagine you're supposed to feel, is that, because it doesn't have a tone like, ooh, he could still be out there, you know, he could come get you. It doesn't have that kind of tone. It has a victorious sort of feel.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought. Maybe he was – I had the exact same reaction to that part of it, because I thought, like, all right, so maybe he's thinking of it in sort of like an urban legend type thing, you know, like some sort of campfire story. It's like, and he's still out there today. Maybe he's right behind you.
Yeah.
You know, but like that, but you're right. I mean, it's too, it's exactly as you said, it's far too victorious. It's like he won something. And that's not, it's not the way you're supposed to view this. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like, what the hell? And, I thought, you know, again, being the armchair director, I thought he was definitely going to start running off and then they would tackle him from behind. They would tackle him off screen, like somebody would get him.
Yeah.
And we'd have a sequence and it'd be, you know, farther on down the road and he's sick and he's, you know, it's a chance for the actor to drop weight and get the heavy makeup and, you know, all of that. And he would be near death and they would pan down and you would see all the bodies with shit all over him.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, okay, well, that's how it's going to end. And then it ended and I was like, oh, James, like, You really, did you read it, buddy? Or what's the deal? Like, did you read the book?
I mean, even if he's running and like he falls into a sinkhole, right?
Yeah.
And he falls into a sinkhole and it just happens to be the cavern where all of his victims are.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then he dies on the floor of the cave. Right. I mean, that's a really incredible coincidence, but it works way better.
Well, yeah, he dies on the floor, or even if he's like suffering or injured on the floor, and then they have to like look down and
yeah.
they see him and the bodies just are near or whatever. Like they would obviously find them, you know, something along those lines. That's Hollywood coincidental. That would have worked so much better, or would have been yeah. true to the spirit of the book. And that's the yeah. thing. Like we were talking about changing things. I'm all for changing things as long as you're going along with the spirit of the book.
Yeah.
Like yeah, if you exactly. change stuff and you're completely missing it, it's like, well, what the hell did you do that for?
Yeah. I mean, unless you're Stanley Kubrick, you don't get to do that.
Sure.
right.
And James like, Franco, you sir, are no Stanley Kubrick.
no. No, he is not.
Yeah. I wonder why I don't know. Like, I feel like I want James Franco to be better at directing than he is.
I do too, because he keeps trying to get his hand, because he seems to think he likes books, and he keeps trying to get his hands on classic works of literature.
Sound of the Fury.
Is he doing the Sound of the Fury?
He did last year. Yeah.
he did. Jesus Christ. Yeah. God damn it. like, yeah. Just if you have the patience for it, try to watch As I Lay Dying.
Okay.
It's going to be tough.
You know what's funny is, okay, so how good does this sound? Okay, so it's The Sound of the Fury.
Mm-hmm.
It stars James Franco, Seth Rogen, Danny McBride, and then Tim Blake Nelson and Scott Hayes and some other people. But it's like you've got your comedy troupe trying to be serious and adapt novels that are much smarter than the people that are trying to adapt them.
He just keeps casting all of his friends.
Yeah.
Except for Seth Rogen, that's pretty much the cast for
and Danny McBride.
Danny McBride is in As I Lay Dying.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah.
Oh no. Wow, that is going to be tough.
And to be honest, Danny McBride, it's a small part, so I mean, it's okay. But like, it just, man, just stop. Like, you know, part of the reason that he did Child of God, is because he wanted to do Blood Meridian, but they wouldn't let him.
Oh. How do you feel about that?
I'm glad they didn't let him. because he shot test footage and
oh,
released
really?
It. Yeah. You can find the test footage. He released it on Vice, but it's on YouTube too. It's a 25-minute, scene from the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that it's test footage, right? So it's not going to be great. The audio is going to be bad. You know, there's going to be, you know, it's the acting's not going to be, nothing about it's going to be polished. But man, did he fuck that up too.
Mm.
I mean, not even close. But that's what concerns me, is he's going to keep trying to get these projects and he's going to keep fucking up these movies. And it's going to make it difficult for somebody else to come along and do it right.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like you're ruining it for everyone else by calling dibs, essentially.
Yeah.
On these different famous works, or you know, famous authors at least.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like he has a stable of pet authors, and he's just going to try to fuck up as many of those books as he can.
Man, alive.
Yeah,
it's too bad.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, and speaking, I mean, now that we're just really just digging into him, you know. His performance in this movie, because he's in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's terrible.
Yeah.
It's the flattest.
Hey, go get thing. Him.
Yeah, hey, go get him.
It definitely was like line reading. It was like,
yeah.
It was so noticeable that I was like, oh, well, there's James Frank. What is he doing that for? You know? It was like, man, this makes this makes the Harry Osborn line reading sound much, much better.
Yeah, it really does.
Hey, Pete. I don't know, man. You're like, what the fuck? Did you just like roll out of bed, or? I mean, geez, that's what it sounds like, and that's what this looks like. It looks like he was late for the scene, and he's just like, "What am I doing? Oh, here's my line. Okay, let's go, roll." You know?
Hey, man, stop him.
Yeah, and I don't always like as an actor. I don't always hate him. I think that I found him fine in 127 hours. Like I liked that more than I expected to. And when he's being funny and poking at himself, I think he's fine. But I just think he's one of those guys that I don't know. He seems like he thinks that he's really smart.
Yeah,
and I don't particularly find him that smart.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it maybe he is, but he just gets the things that I care about wrong.
Yeah. So. Well, maybe he's smart in the way that Zack Snyder's smart, right?
Yeah.
Like he can do bit to bit, but pulling it all together is a little troubling.
Yeah.
A little difficult.
It's a real bummer, man.
It is a bummer. Okay, well, do we have anything else about Child of God before we wrap up?
Read the book.
Yeah, read the book. I took my time, and it took me maybe like a week or so.
Yeah, I mean it's not a very long read. It's and it's like you said, it's sparse. It's not too dense. So
yeah, and I mean the only bit of it's not really even difficult, but the only bit of an obstacle that you have to overcome slightly is the dialect. You know,
it is
very Tennessee 50s, how y'all doing kind of a thing, you know, and it's written like it's spoken. So
yeah, that's one thing that can be difficult, but that McCarthy's really good at. He understands dialects really well.
Yeah, and I think that part of that has to be due to what you were saying earlier about him living in those locations.
Mm-hmm.
And being able just to hear it so often.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay, so yes, definitely check out the book, the film version. If you're curious, if you really liked the book and you maybe wanted to see what it's like, you may want to give it a poke. Like Scott Hayes, poor him, you know, if the film would have done better, I think he would have been a guy that more people would pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was someone that I had never heard of. And I'm like, okay, well, he's definitely, you know, he's a lot better than a lot of people that I know that are cast over and over and over in big productions. So it would be interesting to see him in maybe a little bit better material, at least screenplay material, I guess we'll say.
Yes.
So wrapping us up, if you have any comments, suggestions, or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about specifically for Podshots, you could email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You could follow the show over at Twitter under the handle @plainlabelpod, where you could follow me. I'm @ericwilliams79. We also have a Facebook page for the show where you could like it. Just search for Plain Label Podcast. If you wanted to help us out a little bit, you could head over to amazon.com and search for our wish list. It's full of movies that we want, equipment that we need, and a whole host of other goodies. If you're in the giving mood, just search for the wish list called Plain Label Podcast. So I do want to thank Mr. Krusey for coming on. If people wanted to get a hold of you these days, where would they find you?
Find me on the Twitter.
On the Twitters.
On the Twitters, @ZACKKRUSE. That's there my name.
There you go. All right, so thank you for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with another co-host and another film.
I'd sing more about more of this land, but all God's children ain't free. I'd open up every door I can, 'cause all God's children ain't free. I met a beaten, broken man. He shovels dirt, but got no land. And he held out his hand to me. All God's children ain't free. I'd sing along to a silly song, but all God's children ain't free. I'm gonna sing a blues for the man they done wrong, 'cause all God's children ain't free. Mister, how about the man you condemned to die by taking everything that he's living by and reject him from society? All God's children.